You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
It's all cold down along the beach. The wind's whipping down the boardwalk. Hey, man! You guys know what time of year it is? What time, huh?
6 minutes after 8 on a Thursday, the day before my birthday. Joining me to wish me a happy birthday is Jeff Kenny, Colonel United States Marine Corps, retired. What's up? Go ahead, say it. Say happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Mac.
Thanks.
Every year I miss you, except finally it happened.
Finally, after all these years, it's happened.
Yes.
First of all, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, before we can talk about shit, we have to find out about you so we can know whether we should believe anything you say.
Okay.
You know the deal. You're no stranger to it. Born and raised where?
I was born and raised in Hartford, Connecticut. So I was about 10, then I moved to a small town south of there called Meriden. I lived there until I joined the Marine Corps 1975, when I was 17.
All right, let's talk about...
Right after I barely graduated from high school.
How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, my father and his brothers were in the Navy during the Second World War. And they would speak about the Marine Corps in that things were sometimes rough for them, but things were always rough for those Marines. And Jeffrey, whatever you do, don't join the Marine Corps. And so naturally, that attracted me towards it.
Right.
And
so you're that kid?
I started reading. I read a lot as a kid. I started reading things. And in those days, in the 60s, during Vietnam, as a matter of fact, there's shows on television like Combat, which was basically a squad that went through these different scenarios every week, tactical scenarios like little TDGs. In the France during the Second World War was the setting. And at the same time, after dinner at night, at 6 o'clock, you saw combat every day almost on the news, particularly in 1968 with the Tet Offensive.
Right.
And so I thought, and the Marines were a huge part of that always. And I thought to myself, that's what I want to do. And so I pretty much decided by the time I was a freshman in high school, that as soon as I was eligible and my parents would sign, I was going to join. And that's what I did.
Imagine my surprise. You know, I used to watch, I'm like, how old are you?
I'm 61 now.
So we're the same age. So we watch the same TV shows, right? F Troop, Combat,
right?
Rat Patrol.
Branded.
All those, like, we were like little post-World War II kids by about 12 years. And all that stuff was mainstream TV. And the few hours that it was on after school, we'd come home and watch that shit and then go outside and play it. But I remember, imagine my shock, like on Combat, like, they had this cool guy who used to shoot a Browning automatic rifle, and his name was Cage. He was like Cage was like one of the coolest guys in the show. Kind of quiet, kind of big, rolling around with that bar. And I remember once he got hit, and like Sergeant Saunders, Vic Morrow, looks at him and says, "Cage, you okay?" And he says, "Yeah, it's just shrapnel." I was like, oh, shrapnel, right? So I got the 29 Palms, the second lieutenant the first time, and it's like I see this shit on the ground, this metal, and they're like 9 to 10 inches long and 2 or 3 inches wide, and I'm like, what is that? And they're like, that's shrapnel. I'm like, oh, man, Cage didn't get hit by that shit. I know that.
I know. I mean, they go flying from an artillery piece like hatchet heads. They hit you. It's over.
Yeah.
You're right. I know.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Because I was formed by the Scholastic Book Club and the movies because, you know, we didn't have YouTube or any shit like that. So I read all those books, and the Marines to me in the Pacific and World War II, man, we know we're good at our own propaganda, but those stories were incredible. And I didn't know anybody who was in the Marine Corps, kind of like you a little bit, but I knew I wanted to be a Marine. Now, how could you not have done well? For instance, you have a photographic memory. He's known as Rain Man behind his back to his friends.
I always suspected that.
he's he's, well, maybe not so much behind his back, but he's like, he's this different version of Rain Man. How could you not have been like an A student in high school?
I was. I mean, I was exaggerating about my almost getting thrown out. I was like an honored role, and I got accepted. My mom forced me to put in. They tried to, like, get me to do the NROTC thing, and I put in for colleges, and I got accepted to Rensselaer and Rochester Polytech and Holy Cross, which I think just because my dad was Irish, and you know, it was like a religious scholarship almost, you know, but and we're Catholic, of course, and I waved them all off, and I went and I went to Paris Island. Like about, I joined the Marine Corps the day after I graduated. And
so what year was that, 75, 76?
75. I graduated June 25th. I enlisted the next day, and I went to boot camp on July 7th.
Nice. Nice. What was
here's the thing. My recruiter,
yeah.
I'll never forget this, Mac. I went down to see him like some months before, and I was supposed to see him at 9 o'clock on a Saturday, and I looked in, and the office was shut. And I looked, and I saw this form laying on the couch, and he was wearing dress blue Deltas, which is blue trousers with a red stripe and the short sleeve shirt, and he had a motorcycle helmet on. He's laying on the couch. So I banged on the door, and he kind of woke up a little bit, and he jumped up in a panic, and he wrenched the helmet out off, and he was like, he comes up to me, and he had a million medals, this guy. He had like 3 Purple Hearts. Matter of fact, he was in Bravo Company of 1st Battalion, 26th Marines in Quezon, but I can hit that a little bit later. But he comes to the door, and he opens it, and he goes, yeah, I drank a little bit last night. Fell asleep with a motorcycle helmet on. Woke up, thought I was blind. And I thought, I'm going to like these guys.
What was his name?
His name is Radke. And you might know him, Mac, because when we went to the basic school, I went to the basic school in 1987. By that time, his career had moved on. He was a master sergeant, and he was one of those club guys, and he ran the club at the Hawk.
Are you kidding me? Have you seen the documentary Bravo, Common Man, Uncommon
yes.
Valor?
Yes.
Holy shit, man. My dog had a nervous breakdown in the middle of that thing.
I know. It was awful. And what happened to those guys? And he was telling me about it on the way back. I had to join in Springfield, Mass., or Chicopee. I had to get my physical up there, and he's driving me back, and he starts telling me about his time in Vietnam, and he talked about that ambush and laying there pretending he was dead, and they came up and shot him anyway, and moved on and stuff, and he crawled back, and so it was very compelling. Oh, then he's telling me about he was on embassy duty and stuff, and you know, the canard or the you know, the legendary thing, everybody says the recruiters lied to him. This guy told me the truth. Maybe he was an inexperienced recruiter then, but contrary to being, you know, repelled by it, I felt complimented that he was giving me the straight scoop. And I never went through anything as bad as what those guys went through at Bravo 126.
Yeah, no, again, we've had the guy who produced it.
Right.
And the company commander passed away. Ken Pipes passed away. Did you ever meet Ken Pipes? Mm-hmm.
No, but I remember I read 2 books where he was my hero. One was The End of the Line, which is a story about basically a book about the siege of Quezon. And the other one was Siege in the Clouds, a book by Ray Stubb, who is a former chaplain, who wrote a book about the whole Quezon, the history of Marine involvement in Quezon, which started in 1964 with Major Al Gray going in there with a company from 3rd Marines in 64 before we even landed. And they set up like a radio reconnaissance, you know, prototype radio reconnaissance thing. And then there's nothing going on at that time. So they walked out. But, yeah, you know, it's something that's always interested me for sure.
Yeah, no, I was at his funeral. And, you know what, I wanted him to come on to talk about what he went through because, you know, he felt and then the guy who produced the documentary, Lance Corporal, like third award, Ken Rogers, he tells Pipes, hey, McNamara's, he asks hard questions. And he fucks me over. And he would call me. Yeah, he would call me, like, and we'd shoot the shit. And I did a series of shows on Me Lie because of some shit he asked me. But he was really reluctant to come on because he didn't know where the interview would go. And I said, I don't – look, I'm not a second guesser, man. People can benefit from what you went through, right?
Yep.
And they – he anguished over that patrol, you know,
yeah.
the guidance he gave, the fact that I want to say of the 60 that went out, what – how many got killed? 40 got killed?
Yeah.
And then
it was like only 26, I think, made it ever survive.
Yeah. And then,
it was,
and they left, and their bodies were out there for a month.
For a long time.
And that ate at them. And
right. The thing about Pipes, too, is when they got payback for that,
right.
they did an attack near the end of the siege where, I mean, there was so much complex artillery and mortar support for them. That as they were just rolling up the hill to take that place back, I think the Marines actually went in there with flamethrowers and bayonets.
I mean, that was part of
the documentary, too.
Yeah, I didn't know that they used flamethrowers until I saw that. I was like, holy shit. He said,
Oh, yeah.
And there's a guy named Frank McCauley, who he's the guy that does the Pop Goes the Weasel little thing. And it's like George Costanza at Quezon. He's like this he's like this neurotic guy, but when you're going through the trench with him, you're watching him, and he's not telling a story, man. He's going through that trench again, and he's doing this narrative of this North Vietnamese soldier is popping up and down, and he's doing the same thing. And then he says, well, if I get out of rhythm, then I'll be up when he pops up and I'll shoot him.
Yep.
And he says, and sure enough, I go out of rhythm and he pops up and I can hear my primary marksmanship instructor at Camp Pendleton telling me, hold him and squeeze him.
That's right.
And he said, and I shot him.
Just do the brass.
Yeah, right.
Read, relax, aim, stop, and squeeze.
So we're not going to get very far in this interview. So let's talk about your career. Tell me about the Marine Corps in 1975.
I have to tell you.
Post-Vietnam, that was not like, to honor President Bush, it was not a kinder and gentler place at that point.
No, it was savage. Because what had happened was, near the end of Vietnam, they were having problems getting people. And that's eventually the distaste for the draft led to – we actually drafted people in the Marine Corps. Not many folks know that, but we had draftees in Vietnam. We hadn't done that since a short period of time in 1944. And consequently, in order to get bodies, get people, they lowered the standards in every category, intelligence, morals as in regards to police involvement and drug use. And so consequently, by 1970, and they call it the McNamara program.
No relation.
No relation to you. If it was you, it would have been a better one. This is
exactly.
This is the McNamara Squared program.
McNamara 100,000, I believe it's referred to, right?
So it started as a McNamara 100,000 and went, it just stayed. That was the standard. So we had people who were, what they actually were allowing Cat 5s in the Marine Corps, as far as the intelligence quotient that you get on the ASVAB test to get in the military. Now you can't be below a 31. Matter of fact, we don't even take too many of those. Those are Cat 2s, or Cat 3s rather. But Cat 4 is below that.
What's a Cat?
Cat 5 is below 21.
What?
And we were taking guys like that. So I get to boot camp. A lot of guys didn't speak English. Some of them were going through heroin withdrawal. Some were just hardcore criminals. Twice during the time I was in boot camp, they came. I remember we had this guy named May, and this guy May, a big black dude who was smart and tough, and man, he was on his way to wearing the dress blues. But he was wanted for bank robbery as a civilian, and they came and took him out. And then we had another guy named Hunter. Hunter was primo in every way, and he was the only guy, one of the few people had a guarantee. Most of us just joined up, and you end up as an O3.
Right.
And, He had it, or whatever MOS they needed it, and then you qualify for it. But because we had so many substandard by those measures people coming in, most turned into grunts. But anyway, this guy, Hunter, he was perfect in every way. He was 21 years old, and most of us were either 18 or 19, and a few of us, like me, were still 17. And this guy, the one problem he had, he couldn't swim. He got in the pool, he panicked, and he actually shit in the pool. Like Caddyshack, where the Mars bar or whatever's floating in the water. It wasn't
baby,
no Mars bar.
Baby Ruth, you dumbass.
Baby Ruth.
I'm like telling everybody I'm playing up your Rain Man memory, and you go ahead and you blow that. Are you kidding me?
I think if you look into it, really, it was a Mars bar masquerading as a Babers. But let's not get tied up with that. Anyway, this guy, so because of that, I got the Dress Blues. I got Meritorious PFC out of boot camp because we lost those two guys. One, because he couldn't swim, and the other one because he was a bank robber. But and so consequently, when I got out of boot camp, the whole first year I was in there, I mean, I had a lot of fist fights when I was a kid. There wasn't a year from my time in sixth grade in junior high school to my senior year that I didn't get suspended at least once for fighting in school. And I wouldn't be eligible now because of that, I don't think, to join the Marine Corps. But then they didn't give a – they could care less. And so – but my first year in the Marine Corps, I mean, I was fighting to keep my pay. They had gangs that would extort money from you and stuff. And
explain.
Drugs in the barracks. It was incredibly bad.
Explain, because people won't understand that. Well, how would they – there used to be a thing called the paymaster that would show up on payday.
Yeah.
Explain.
You got paid in cash. And you went up and you – you got paid in cash at 29 Palms. At most other places in the Marine Corps, you got a check. And then while I was at 29 Palms, the checks made it to 29 Palms. But it was a relatively new thing. Yeah. A lot of things we take for granted now were brand new then.
Yeah, let me tell you, on sea duty, I can remember the paymaster, right? And we had three Marines that were detailed, two with shotguns, mm-hmm. one with an NCO with a pistol, escorted the paymaster to a table. He had the series of pages, everybody's name, and then how much they were to get paid, or some of them, because we were getting advanced at that part of our Marine Corps history, were going to get green checks. And he had a ruler. So you walk up, hand him your ID, he'd say, McNamara, Lance Corporal, put his ruler down, $243, and you get they'd pay you in cash, and that's how you got paid, the paymaster.
Yeah, and we had a lot of... We had murders. We had constant fighting. There was race fights. There was just fights, like I say, to hang on to your pay. It was bad. I used to lie in letters home to my parents. Oh, yeah, we're doing this. We're doing that. And we were doing stuff, but it was just, it was a disappointment. And then I wasn't even out of boot camp a year, and they came around and said, Kenny, you're going on embassy duty. And I'm thinking, oh, that was great. I remember my recruiter telling me about how good embassy duty was.
Right.
And I thought, and I'll get out of here. The Marine Corps was like an archipelago of penal institutions, you know, populated by savage people. And I mean, I was no nice guy, but these were, a good minority of these guys were actually hardcore criminals. And so consequently, we weren't that good. But I have to tell you, I have to qualify that. When we went to the field, and when they were good, when you had them occupied and doing combat type stuff, the retards, the drug addicts, the criminals, they pulled together, you know. And something we didn't now in the Marine Corps in my last 10 years or so, 10-20 years really, we had a problem with suicide. We didn't have a problem with suicide. We had a problem with murder, and we were murdering each other. And the Marine Corps had the highest desertion rate in those days of any of the four services. Because people joined the Marine Corps and are like, oh my God, you know, I didn't think I was going to have to actually wake up in the morning and the Marine Corps did not compromise, you know. We got two commandants during that time. Lewis Wilson, who became commandant about a week after I got to Paris Island, and after him, Bob Barrow. And those two guys were highly decorated. World War II and Korean vets. Wilson had the Medal of Honor from Guam in World War II, and Barrow had the Navy Cross from the Chosin Reservoir in 1950. And both of them, and Barrow had been the CO of the 9th Marines, and it was basically his plan to do the famous operation now known as Dewey Canyon in 1969. And those guys would not compromise on quality. So when the Marine Corps came back and started achieving good results from the reforms we made in boot camp and recruiting, we, I think, really benefited the most of all the other services because these brave dudes, these morally courageous men, held the line. And when we got and General Kelly, who was after him in the early 80s, and then it was the perfect end to that little dynasty. It was like the five good Roman emperors, you know, the four great commandants. The perfect end to that was Al Gray and the validation of all the baloney I just said was the Marine Corps performance in Desert Storm. So, so I went through that in the first part of my career, and I went on embassy duty, and I went to, of all places, Tehran, Iran, in 1976, in December. And I stayed there for about 14 months. I came home in February of 78, and it was the best place I ever was in my life. The Marines there were cut above the type of guys who were being recruited at that point. And we just cruised in good. We had an outstanding NCRC. Our gunny was a guy with a lot of Vietnam time. He was in 1-5 as a mortarman in 1966-67. And there's a book by Bing West called Small Unit Action in Vietnam, and his company's mentioned there twice. Once for rescuing Jimmy Howard, the reconnaissance platoon sergeant who was trapped on Howard's Hill in July of 66, getting him off of that. And then again, a huge gunfight they had in that area right outside of Anwar, going towards north towards Da Nang. And Bing West kind of immortalized him with those two vignettes. And we had the guy who was the mortar section leader, and then later on he was a platoon sergeant. He was my NCIC, and that guy's name was Ron Stepp, Ronnie Lee Stepp, and he affected me in my career. I mean, he just was my vision of what a Marine NCO and staff NCO should be. I mean, he was no sweetie pie, and he was pretty rugged, but he was. He was a true Marine staff and CO.
What do you mean by that? I talked to Mike Musselman. You know Mike?
Right. Oh, yeah, Gunner. Yeah.
Yeah, Gunner. And so, you know, he says, look, I love him, man. And because I love you, I'm going to train the living shit out of you. I'm going to make you into something that is not going to die for some stupid-ass reason because you don't know what you're doing. All right? And you might hate my guts, but I don't really care.
Right? That's right.
And
that's how Gunny was.
Yeah.
That's how Gunny Stepp was. Yeah. To the point where I reenlisted, Mac, from embassy duty. I was in my second post was Germany.
Well, let me ask you this. When do those guys, they get yoked up in 79, 78?
Yeah. Well, General Wilson became count and right away went to work on it. And
No. I mean, when does the embassy get taken over?
The embassy was first attacked on Valentine's Day, 1979. February.
And when had you left?
I left in February of 78.
Okay,
so I was gone for a year.
I knew some of those guys.
Like, I know Steve Kirtley and I knew Jimmy Lopez.
What was Iran like? Was it a good place to work at the time?
Yeah, it was. Well, the city was huge.
Right.
And Tehran is a huge city, and at that point, I got there, and about a third to so like two-fifths of the women were wearing blue jeans and miniskirts. They had like female traffic cops.
Whoa.
And they had bars, which were hugely expensive. And but then you had about a little bit more than half were still in what they call over there chadors. You know, they're what you call a burqa. You know, they're
right.
And they and the fundamentalist stuff was a reaction against the Shah was really trying to modernize Iran.
Right.
And so, like, their army, they had a pretty good air force. They had the best air force in the Middle East.
Right.
There's a lot of American contractors there. There's a lot of American military. There's, like, maybe about 4 miles from the embassy was this place called Amish Mag, which is full of Army and Air Force advisors who were training the Iranians. So you had your special forces guys. You had conventional guys. There was no Marines in there, though, besides us. There was about 16, 17 of us on duty, on embassy duty at that time. And, it was a very tight group. You know, I'm still friends. One of my buddies was retired from the DEA. Another one, retired as the, assistant DA out there in, Riverside County recently. So, you know, we stayed tight. And when I reenlisted, I reenlisted to go to the grunts at Camp Pendleton because that's where the gunny was. He was a company gunny in 5th Marines, and I went to 3-5, right where he was.
What year?
That was 79, June of 79. And he said, look, I told him I was coming. And he said, look, I'll pick you up at the bus station in Oceanside. so he picked me up in a Corvette with no back seat. and I'm in Alphas, and I'm holding my sea bag and my, like, my suitcase and stuff, you know? He lived in that, I can tell you because you know Pendleton. There's like a high rise right there on the other side as you're driving down.
Right.
There's a little bar called the Flying Bridge.
Yep.
And beyond that, he lived there and he spent all his free time at the Flying Bridge. But,
the reason I want to go down that road is Marine Corps was a very different place than it is today. And I love to interview people that had some kind of personal interaction with General Barrow and General Walt and guys like Harvey Barnum.
Harvey Barnum, the artillery guy.
Yeah.
He's a FO for 1-9. We're over there on an inspection tour, and he did that, and that happened. He got the Medal of Honor, yeah.
Yeah, and the story he tells is he came back to Hawaii. He was TAD there because they convinced the barracks commander that, hey, we should go there and check it out, and that way we can come back and train our Marines because they're going to go there. And so Barnum goes there and does what he does. He comes back, and he becomes the aide for General Walt. And so Walt knows, like, Ray Davies and all these other guys.
Oh, Barrow, yeah.
Right? They're all boys. And so so I think Davies might have been FMF PAC at the time or something.
Well, if at that time, if you're talking about when Harvey Barnum went over, he ended up as a CG of the 3rd Mar Div, Davies did.
Okay, so he's working for Walt.
Right, and he was working for Walt. Walt was the one who went from being – he was he was hired, man. He was running the whole math there, you know?
And so Barnum tells this funny story that Walt says, look, Lieutenant, if you can hang in there and be my aide for a year, I'll send you anywhere you want to go. And so he says, okay. He said, I did it. And so he says, all right, where do you want to go? He said, I want to go back to Vietnam. I want to be a battered commander there. He said, you can't go. He said, you're a Medal of Honor guy. And then he says,
wow.
Yeah, and he says, bullshit. He said, Davies did. Other guys did it.
Yeah, Archie Van Winkle did.
Yeah, the other guys did it. Like, why can't I? And so he said, Walt looked at me. He's going to kill me. He said, you just can't. He said, so we argued for about a month. And he said, like, he wasn't going to send me back there. Come on, I'm a first lieutenant. What am I not going to command the rest of my life because of the medal? But he tells these great stories of being able to be in a small group company of, like, the Valhalla of the Marine Corps in the 60s, right, post-World War II. And it, very, very, very cool. Talk to us about your decision to get commissioned. How does that happen? How long were you with 5th Marines? Were you with you were 3-5 for how long?
I was at 5th Marines for a little bit more than, like, 15 months. Okay. And I went there, and we were the 3rd unit to do UDP. The UDP was a new concept to make up for the fact that we didn't have as many Marines as we used to. It used to be you went to Okinawa for a year, and then you spent half that year doing tactical stuff if you're lucky, and the rest of the time you're kind of like we're fapped to different things. And so in order to save money, a guy at PP&O, who you probably heard of, came up with this idea. He was a major that we could fly guys over and they'll fall in on gear. And that was Oliver North, and he did that as a major. And so they tried it. And the first guys who went over were 1-5 and then 2-5. And then I went over in February of 80. We were the 3rd guys to do it. And then it was like an avalanche. Guys from Lejeune, other regiments in Pendleton started doing the UDP thing.
Right.
So I did that, and I came back, and I tried out for first recon, and I got into first recon. From like August of 80, and I left there in July of 82, and I got put on recruiting duty as a staff sergeant. And I had always wanted to be an officer because you know how it is in the Marine Corps. You become a fire team leader, and you think after a while, I could do the squad leader's job.
Yeah, easy.
And then squad leader, you think, you know what? I could do the lieutenant's job.
Yeah, what does he do?
Yeah, so although it's different when you actually get it, you know. But,
exactly. Oops.
And so I always had in my mind, and to the point where people would bring it up to me, like my CO, my second post on embassy duty from like 78, 79 was where the company headquarters was. We guarded the consulate, but the headquarters was in there. So I got to know those guys, and the commanding officer of the company was a major named McGowan, who later he retired as a colonel. he said, you should be an officer. I mean, he looked at my book and everything. He's a very thorough guy. He goes, your GT is high enough. You should do it. He wrote me a letter, which I kept.
Wow.
And he did. And then my battalion commander was a guy named, in 3-5, also wrote me a letter. I was a state platoon sergeant when I left there as a sergeant. And he wrote me a letter. His name was J.L. Williams, and he had been a company commander at Dai Do. Matter of fact, he was Vic Taylor's company commander.
Holy shit.
Yeah, he had like 2 silver stars, a Purple Heart. He's a very good guy.
Yeah, these guys are rolling. These guys were. I was at Margarita in 1984, right? That's when I get to one class. Yeah, these guys were rolling around. Like, our regimental commander was a guy named Marty Brantner. Two Navy crosses.
A little short guy.
Yeah, and he had like most of his like right calf shot off, and so he'd put on his like red silkies every day at lunch at 11:30,
yeah.
And he'd go for a run around the base, and you know we're second lieutenants, and we're like, and we're watching him limp around on his half blown off leg, and we're like, dude, that dude is harder than shit.
And I know it.
Our sergeant major.
He got those 2 Navy crosses like 10 days apart.
Our sergeant major. It's, yeah, that story. Our sergeant major, his name was Sakamano. And yeah. You couldn't even understand anything he said.
Yeah.
He'd like take the battalion formation and it sounded like this. And when he said, the whole thing went. Right? Because they knew what the son of a bitch
every
meant.
Every other word is the F-bomb, so you understand at least half of what he says.
Exactly. And so, but I remember I went to him as a second lieutenant to ask him, I had a sergeant by the name of Jarrett, Tony Jarrett. Dad was sergeant major. Brother was, I think, a gunny at the time in the 1st Marine Division. And I had some not-so-good sergeants that were more senior to him, and my platoon sergeant was going to go finish his GED because he hadn't graduated high school. And so...
Wait a minute. Does Jarrett become an officer?
No. He retires as a master guns.
Go ahead.
But he... So I want Jarrett. Jarrett's the most talented guy, and he's the actual leader, right? He runs my platoon. The other guys, he listen to what he says. Jared, he's like a maniac with, and he had the highest technology that we had back then, which was a green platoon sergeant notebook, right? When you got one of, that was like, you became a made man when you got one of those here.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, look at this. I have one of these now. So I went to him and I said, hey, Sergeant Major, you got a minute? He said, yeah, come on in. And I sat down and he was probably like 6'5". He's a big dude. And I said, what role does seniority play in me selecting a platoon sergeant from my squad leaders? And he looked at me and he said, it's a factor. He said, if everything's equal, should be the senior guy. If it's not equal and you have an outstanding sergeant, he's the guy who gets the first shot. He said, look, this is a meritocracy. Seniority is a factor when all other things are equal. If it's not equal, you owe your Marines the best leadership.
Yep.
I was like, thank God. I went running back. I'm like, yeah. And then
it has to be like that because most of the time, you're like supposed to have 42, 43 guys. You're going to end up with, like, you're lucky 30 people.
Right.
So you got to just, and you got to, you want to, basically your platoon, your rifle platoon is it's a threshing machine of death, you know, that between using your automatic weapons and fire and maneuver and stuff, absent even any kind of fire support, the ethos that's been in the Marine Corps since the end of World War I up till now, the fire and movement ethos, you know, culminated with close combat and everything, is frightening to other countries because whether you're talking about 2-7, you know, during the Desert Storm, or there's been instances right up till we left Afghanistan where Marine units are doing fire movement on a bunch and they just can't handle it. And that's an art form that, you know, you and I pushed at IOC but even before that,
right.
You know,
yeah, just
the whole idea was these guys should be able to accomplish the mission on their own, you know?
You know, it's funny. I told the story before, but we intercepted, you know, this thing, this Taliban, you know, message. And it said, you don't understand, the Marines that are coming to Helmand are not like the other forces in the American military. They consider themselves the fanatical warriors of the of the United States military going back to their fighting the Japanese in World War mm-hmm. II. They will not run from our machine guns. They will run towards our machine guns. It was like, you read it, you're like, yeah, this is awesome. We need to get this to our recruiters, man. They need to put this shit out there. The, so let's talk, so you get commissioned. My guest this morning, as I told you, this interview is not going to go the way it should because we've got about 21 more minutes. Jeff Kenney, Colonel United States Marine Corps, retired here recently, less than a year ago, yes?
No, I retired March of 17.
March of 17.
So a little bit more than a year. Yeah.
A little bit more than a year. So, your decision you get pushed to go get commissioned.
Right.
When do you go to the basic school? When do you get commissioned? And then what do you do?
Okay, I was a MESAP. Marine Corps sent me to school, and that's a great program which still exists. And I went to University of Colorado because I was recruiting in Colorado at the time. And, so I graduated from there in May of 87. I got commissioned the day I graduated. And I started the basic school in June or July of 87, Fox Company 87. And then we graduated in December, and I started IOC in January, and I hit the fleet, 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines, in March of 88.
Nice. All right, now, you're the recipient of the Leftwich Trophy, yes?
Right.
All right, that's a big deal. We would tease him and say, look, first of all, nobody else was fighting, and you and you didn't screw it up, all right? So don't like dial down the trumpets, okay? The rest of us know what the fuck's going on. Talk about your experience in Liberia.
Well, I did two mute sock pumps in 3-8. First one 89 to 89-90, or 89, it was like a six-month pump. And then the next one, we were due to leave in August of 90, and as we were leaving, Saddam invaded Kuwait, and 2-4, which was on the float, was getting ready to go into Liberia. So we knew we were going right over to Africa to relieve them in Liberia, and we did. And the reason was because there's a civil war going on that made it untenable to have American civilians there, and they were going to evacuate the embassy. That was the plan at the time. They didn't evacuate the entire embassy. They left a skeleton crew in there guarded by the Marines, and we ended up having that mission. So that was my first time there. And it was in the capital city of Monrovia, Liberia. It's butt up against the coast, this place called Mamba Point. The backyard was the Atlantic Ocean to this thing.
All right.
Very small compound. And so I was there. I was the last Marine from TUMAF to leave Liberia that particular time because we got replaced by Fast Company once the airport was able to be opened in January of 91, which is right before we started the bombing campaign against Saddam, which I think was January 16th.
Right.
And we got out of there January 11th. I walked out of there with my pack in one hand and a 2-9 or 2 from the from our comm guys in the other.
Nice.
And
you're essentially, supporting a NEO should it need to occur.
Right.
Is that what you're doing?
Yes. We between 2-4, the guys from 2-4 and us, we evacuated about 2,400 Americans, 2,420 something. And first it was a lot of them, a couple hundred a day, and then it slowed down to a trickle. But that was the total, finally. And then, I went and I left the fleet, got promoted to captain, was there at the basic school and then the infantry officer course where you and I met. And then I went to the amphibious warfare school and I went back to the fleet as a captain. I went back to Camp Lejeune and I was a company commander in 2-2. We went on another float. And while we're over there, this war kicked up again. And we went right back to Monrovia, Liberia, right back to Mamba Point, right back to the embassy. And now, instead of being a lieutenant there, I was a company commander, and me and the other two rifle companies would rotate in there 8 days apiece.
But you're the smartest guy. You're the king of the kingdom, right?
Well, and that's the thing. Nobody had been to Liberia before in the battalion except me.
That's awesome.
They flew me from – I was on an LSD, an old-fashioned LSD. I was the mech company guy, the AAV companies.
Cool.
And I got flown to the Big Dev, which was the Guam, also known as the Give Up and Masturbate, That was the ship, if you watch Heartbreak Ridge, that was the one that did Grenada and Beirut, all that stuff, too. So I went to Guam. I gave a brief on Liberia. And as you know, I was doing that when I was an instructor at IOC. Matter of fact, I was doing it before I became an instructor from Weapons Company. You remember that, Mac? To lieutenants. And so I gave basically that.
Yeah.
And we went in there, and this was way different. We had inherited, in Monrovia, we had inherited the British Embassy, which was adjacent to the American Embassy. And that became like the ambassador's residence. And it was right next to the embassy, right there in the end of this peninsula called Mamba Point, which was in the, like the governance area of Monrovia, so to speak. And that changed the whole mission because unlike where we were in the city before, there's 5 and 6 story buildings across from us. The British Embassy was right on the beach. So there was you could see down the road, you had a couple hundred yards in front of us. And, one day, one of the factions came right at us and they started firing up the embassy. And of course we shot back and, we killed some of them. I had 2 guys get wounded and then they made contact with us and they said, look, we just want to get by. We're getting attacked from the other end by another group and we can't handle them. So basically my battalion commander and the ambassador who was there at that time, they said, all right, let them come by. This is kind of a bizarre scenario, but because we had a pretty intense fight for about an hour and a half. And then they took their magazines out of their weapons and they walked by with their weapons over their heads. And some of them were wearing women's dresses and football helmets and like they had female bras on their head. It was a very bizarre, you know, primitive type scene. They walked by and then the group that had been attacking them came up behind them and they didn't know who we were. They hadn't been in that part of Monrovia before. They attacked us too. And that precipitated another gunfight that lasted another 2 hours. And we killed, you know, probably, I'd say about a dozen of the next group. And the fight lasted on and on for like 4.5 hours all total. And, without spending too much time on it, my Marines, based on my subordinate leaders and the squad leaders I had, they just were superb. And we couldn't, my instinct was to attack outside of the compound and, because these guys were on their last legs by about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I wasn't allowed to do that. The rules of engagement were no movement beyond the, you know, the boundaries of the U.S. government property, which is the embassy compound.
Right.
So we had to become experts at figuring out how to fire on people from one angle to get them to move to an exposed position from another position, communicate with our own guys who could take them under fire and take them under fire. My folks became real good at it. And I got the credit for what they did. I ran back and forth encouraging them and giving them the word to fire when they – sometimes it was a little dicey. Right. There were civilians out there who were hunkering down trying to stay out of the way. And so we didn't use any fragmentary munitions. I mean, I desperately wanted to shoot, my 203s out there, and we started actually run low on ammo because in order to move laterally, we had to put out fire to cover ourselves. Because they were shooting at us. And, there's a point they were running a little low on ammo. So they were watching us too. I mean, they could see what we were doing, you know, fits and snatches. So I had my guys put their gas masks on and we put smoke out there and they thought it was gas and they ran away for about 15, 20 minutes. that trick ain't going to work again. And this gas mask sucks when it's 110 degrees, 100% humidity, you know? That's what happened. Finally, we got a call. Now, look, I'm going to say this, and people aren't going to believe me, but you can Google it, I guess. And the guy in charge of this second group was this guy who called himself General Buck Naked. And he called the embassy to talk to me. Now, my battalion commander was there, and he was great. It was Walt Gaskin. He came down. He watched me for a while. He told me I was doing good. He asked me what I needed. You know, he was very supportive, but they called the switchboard at the embassy, and the embassy punched him down to my position, and my radio operator, a kid named Gilbert, goes, "Sir, I have General Buck Naked on the line for you." So I go, "Captain Kenny speaking." He goes, "Hey, man, if I come up there, you going to shoot me, man?" I go, "Well, if you don't shoot at me, we won't shoot at you." And I go, is it okay for me to say it? I'm like, I got my hand, I'm talking to my XO. I go, check with the colonel, see if that's okay. And it was, you know. And so he came by in a big, a Bronco, and he had a cowboy hat on. He had guns all over him, like Josie Wales, waving at us. And that was it. You know, that ended the gunfight.
Wow. Joshua Milton Belayi, better known as his nom de guerre or pseudonym, General Butt Naked.
General Butt Naked. And I heard he became a preacher.
Yeah, Belayi, originally known as a tribal priest, since the war he has converted to Christianity and become a preacher.
Yep. He's a Kron. The guys who ran the government were Krons. And they looked almost East African, a lot of them,
right.
You know? And General Buck Naked's guys fought almost naked. They had, like, little white diapers on, and they had their faces painted white. And later on, they'd come by the embassy, and my guys would go, hey, man, because they're young grunts, you know? Right. Hey, man, I come and get your face painted white. Hey, so my enemies won't see me, man. I can see you. Well, you must be my friend. So, yeah, it was, I thought to myself, and it's the first time I was in combat a couple times after that in Iraq and Afghanistan, and this thought, I said, I never thought my war would be like this. General Buck Naked,
I don't remember,
guys wearing dresses, and
I don't remember Sergeant Saunders dealing with this shit on combat.
Yeah, Sergeant Saunders never had this.
Yeah, no
Paige
shit.
And Kitch and Kirby never had to deal with this.
No, they were like locked on. Talk to me, give me a lesson learned as a captain. From that experience.
Well, the first thing is preparation.
Leadership.
I knew this from, I didn't know it. I was advised this from guys who had seen action at that level. Starting with the CO of the basic school when I went through as a lieutenant was Terry Ebert, who had the Navy Cross as a company commander in 2-5.
Yeah.
And he was very good. He talked to the IOC classes and stuff. He said, if there's only one thing you can do to train your guys up, train in your infantry platoon commander, squad in the assault, fire and movement, close with and destroy. He says, because that has so many other lessons that get taught to it, especially if you're doing live fire. And that I found to be true over and over, because doing that type of live fire where you're moving and firing in support of each other, it develops trust. It develops implicit communications between your men where, they become knowledgeable of each other's strengths and weaknesses faster than any other way. And because they're shooting, they have deadly weapons, and they're shooting at the more realistic you can make it, the better. But if you can just do it squad by squad, that will pay off.
Oh, my God. And, and that's honestly, our friends, the way our bond is that we love to teach squad squad tactics.
Yep.
You other idiots want to go do the war and go do lieutenant's complete free play, go ahead. I'm on the B team. I'll be at range 5. And and I'll tell you, I mean, we came to this with all very similar experiences. And the one that I discovered in the fleet, I go to range 400 as a second lieutenant, and I'm doing, first fire team, prepare to rush. Now we're shooting live rounds. We're trying to shoot targets. Nobody's fucking moving. They can't fucking see me. And afterwards, I'm pissed. I'm like, this shit doesn't work. This is bullshit. The way I got taught is bullshit. And I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to control fucking Sergeant Belayi, my base squad.
You guys watch what I do and you go off there.
Yeah.
That's it.
Belayi's going to control Propst. Everybody moved in that fire team in the squad moves when Propst moves, and the two adjacent squads, you're going to move when the base squad moves, because I'm not going to be able to control your ass. What?
And that is the best thing, because then it becomes like a hockey team or a basketball team.
They're exactly.
It's not like okay, first down. Okay, let's have a huddle and decide what we're going to do for second down. That's not how it is. It's not a football game.
No.
It's a rugby game. You know what I mean? It's like you're not going to have time to give implicit commands or explicit commands. Everything has to be implicit. What does he want me to do, and how do I know what he wants me to do? Because I'm watching what a guy who sees him doing.
And I've done it with him so many times. I know.
Exactly.
And I'm going to influence you by my movement, not by...
Correct.
No, the shit you would see, you'd be throwing rocks at the motherfucker while he's shooting.
Right.
Hey, hey, hey! guess I did.
Could you throwing remember? Rocks is right.
Yeah, we're
that's
hey,
how
we're
lieutenants get killed.
Yeah, we're
not
so
charging the enemy.
We're
they're
so
trying to get from first squad to second squad yeah, to see what the fuck's going on.
We're so
and,
fucked
you know,
up, and nobody and no, we're so fucked up, and nobody's even shooting at us. What's gonna happen when somebody shoots at us?
Yeah,
we gotta fucking hunker down, man, and hope that somebody drops a nuke and saves our ass. And
that's
so,
right. When you get your guys together, though, they're gonna say that. Fuck, we can't fucking do shit. And there's not even a, and you can say, look, two things. Number one, we're going to do this implicit command thing. And number two, the other guy's got the same fucking problems we got. It, who's going to win is who gets their shit together first. And it's going to be us.
Right.
And, you know, the guy, the enemy, you know. And so, you know, you can make it work that way. And I know that when we at ILC were, the lieutenants had gone through the base school doing squad on the golf course. And they got to us, and this is what you guys did before I got there,
right,
like
right,
you and Paul Kennedy
right,
and guys like that.
Right.
You can't do any fire commands or hand and arm signals. Remember that?
Right.
You guys started doing that.
Yeah.
I'm like,
no,
that's fucking genius. I
started doing that with my platoon as second lieutenant, and at first they like, Lieutenant, this is bullshit. And then they saw us do it, and then we did a live fire night attack, if you can imagine this. And like nobody would move except my platoon. My platoon ate it up. And my company commander came and said, Mac, like, what was that? I'm like, well, sir, I had to hold my guys back because the rest of those guys went to the ground and we couldn't get too far out in front because those dumbasses would shoot us. But this is what I do. And he's like, can you teach that to everybody? So then Kennedy and I write an article called
won't the first fire team rush? I read that like a million times.
Right. And then that gets published in the Gazette. And then we just started doing it. And the lieutenants were like, well, why don't we get to start this, taught this shit from the start? Like, just shut up, Lieutenant, okay? You wouldn't understand it. It's way too complex, okay? And then when we all went to IOC, we took it over there, and we did it during the day, but the big epiphany was doing it at night.
Doing it at night.
The confidence they got at night, and it was really interesting. We'd get staff NCOs into the class, and we'd say, we're going to do a live fire night attack. And they'd be like, with second lieutenants? And at the end of it, they were like, this was incredible. I've never felt as confident, moving, knowing what I was doing. It was awesome. And so that was a group of guys that we were with. And we're still all good friends. A bunch of us were together General Furness's change of command at Camp Lejeune. It was awesome.
We were there till 4 in the morning. And we weren't even drunk. We were too busy running our mouths.
Exactly. We were sober, which doesn't happen very often. All right, look, you have to come back next week.
I will.
All right.
I will be here.
Well, just tease everybody. How did you get into the advisor business in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, my first tour in Iraq, I was a 3 of a MU, and we were rolling up people using the Maritime Special Purpose Force, and we weren't getting bad guys. We were just getting people we weren't being effective. And I realized that when you get to the counterinsurgency phase, you got to persuade like-minded folks among the civilian among the population who want to be on your side. You got to support them. Otherwise, you can't call it a win. And that's what we've been going through since really 2001 in Afghanistan, and since 2003 in Iraq. And that's why I became an advisor.
So you become an advisor. How many times have you done it?
I did 3 times in uniform and once as a contractor. Once in Iraq, twice in Afghanistan in uniform, and then once in Afghanistan as a civilian contractor.
All right. So,
and I ran 2 schools to train them. One at Camp Pendleton, the advisor training branch, and then that's my clock. I apologize. I was the advisor training group for the Marine Corps at 29 Palms. From 13 to 14.
Are you shitting me? That goes off every hour?
Yep. So it's Hemingway would love it, because whenever I hear it, I say, for whom the bell, ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee.
Whoa. Now that's got a bond 9 fucking times?
Yet, so.
Jesus Christ. Why, does somebody have somebody have a problem telling time in your house?
Yes. We're always trying to coordinate.
Nice.
So, you know,
I got it.
I try to remind my wife that what time it is so that we're not late.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
It's a lot harder problem to solve than the fire and movement thing, let me tell you.
All right.
All right, man.
No, first of all, no, awesome stuff. And we'll do this again, and then we'll bring Tim Lynch is riding now more.
Oh, I know. That's great.
And so we'll have you on next week, hopefully, if you can do next week. And then we'll bring both you guys on, and we'll talk about advising in Afghanistan and the future that you see in Afghanistan, because it's not easy to understand, right?
Right.
And what we're doing there, how we define victory there, what is victory there, and all of that. And so I want to footnote that and explain that to people. So appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you, Mac, and happy birthday again. So you just turned 62, right?
61.
Damn it. You're younger than me, that means. Damn.
Hey, Musselman said hello.
Oh, I say hi back, Gunner.
No, he's coming on next. All right, man, I will give you a call. We'll set up next week. Thanks for doing this.
Okay, Mac. Thanks to you. Bye-bye.
Jeff Kenny, in addition to being funny, he is a good dude. He's tough, smart. And you can see, like the Gunner, my friends, I have awesome Marine Corps friends. I was really lucky to fall in with a group of guys, and then you got to perform your way in. But Kenny is hilarious. We had a good time in North Carolina. We'll take a quick break. Gunner is standing by to join us. More of All Marine Radio coming up on a Thursday, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Readboard page at allmarineradio.com.